Welcome back to The Infectious Myth. Thank you for tuning in to episode 53. If you've got a comment during the show, you can call 888-874-4888. At any time, you can email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com, like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. We're also on iTunes and other podcast programs, so if you can't listen live, you can listen to us as an MP3 file afterwards. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you, and if you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, your thoughts on the show, and your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift. And as I mentioned last week, it's a good time to support PRN. It's been really difficult for them with their studio becoming unlivable and having to find new space, their website crashing, et cetera, so now would be a good time to sponsor PRN.fm so you can keep good programs coming. Today, I will discuss the film Trace Amounts, subtitled Autism, Mercury, and the Hidden Truth, with filmmaker Eric Gleydon. But he is more than just a filmmaker because he suffered tremendously after receiving a tetanus vaccine in 2004 containing the ethylmercury preservative thimerosal. His symptoms were very similar to those of a child with autism, and it was not until he took chelation therapy to remove the mercury that his symptoms started to regress. But first, a little bit of feedback from our listeners. Yazoo via email said, "Your show is one of my favorites, and I hope we'll have you on the air for a long time to come." Well, that's what I'm planning. So if you do have feedback, make sure I hear about it, and it doesn't all have to be positive. If you've got constructive criticism, I'd love to hear that too, and I do like to hear about new guests. Many of these guests come from suggestions from listeners. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Thank you.
I'll ask you more about your own story later, but first let's get to the issue of mercury and autism for those who aren't too familiar. The rate of autism was about 1 out of 10,000 from the 1950s until the late 1980s, and then it shot up to 1 out of 250 by 2000, 1 out of 150 by 2007, and it's estimated as 1 out of 88 children today. And how much of that is a real increase, and how much is simply that people are more aware of the condition?
Yeah, that's a good question. Kind of bear with me because I'm on a tail end of a cold, so my voice isn't all that good. But, I guess it was through the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, pretty much five decades, autism was, 1 in 10,000, but technically anywhere between 1 to 4 per 10,000. And then right around 89, the published studies show that 89 was kind of the turning point of when autism started really rising drastically. And as of today, in fact, the latest CDC rates are 1 in 68 children. There's really no doubt that some of the increase is based on better diagnosing, expanding criteria and so forth. That is going to play some role in the increase. However, going from 1 in 10,000 to 1 in 68, we would be a pretty clueless society if we didn't know of 1 in 68 children, for five decades with autism. So there's definitely something else going on.
Right. Now, there is this kind of a big war going on over what the cause is, and, of course, there are people who believe the vaccines are the major cause, but the people, especially the people who promote vaccines and notably the CDC, they don't believe this. So what are they promoting as the cause of autism?
Yeah, so, the CDC has taken a pretty clear stance. In fact, I don't even believe they've ever used the word epidemic, even though we've got 1 in 68 children with autism. However, they really kind of keep grasping on to the fact that it's based on better diagnosing. Every time the CDC makes a comment in these congressional hearings talking about the rate, they always say they don't know what's going on. However, it's pretty clear that better diagnosing criteria is playing a role. So they kind of stick to that, and they really want to look into the genetic side of this. And to tell you the truth, there's no such thing as a genetic epidemic. There's no way.
Yes.
There's no such thing as a genetic epidemic where we could spike from 1 in 10,000 to 168 in 1 to 2 decades.
Because if there was a genetic cause for this, then it should be relatively constant throughout history. And if the gene required an environmental condition to be activated, then you have to ask the question of, well, what is that environmental factor, and can it by itself cause this condition?
Yeah, and I, th- I think even the from both sides, or every argument at this point, from the biggest people from both sides of the argument, are pretty clear right now that autism comes down to two factors. One, there's a genetic susceptibility. You've got to have that genetic susceptibility. And the second being, you have to have an environmental trigger. Something in the environment is triggering this. And that's the question. What is the environmental trigger? And that's what we kind of really want to get to the bottom of in regards to the mercury theory. Let's put that
right. Now, I think it's fairly widely known, but in the in one of the Alice in Wonderland books, there was the Mad Hatter, and the Hatters treated the felt. I think it was a lot of it was beaver fur that came from Canada, but they treated it with mercury, and they had a tendency to go mad. Maybe mad is not the right word, but to have serious neurological illness. It's been known for a long time that that mercury is toxic. But let's talk about three different kinds of mercury. There's ethyl and methyl organic mercury, and then there's metallic mercury. So can you describe the difference and how this fits into the vaccine controversy?
Yeah, so elemental mercury is what you would, when you've got in a thermometer or what you play with on your, on your desk when you were a kid, that kind of rolls around. Mercury is a really interesting metal because it is liquid at room temperature. And so elemental is what you'd find in your silver fillings in your mouth. I think elemental is what's in fluorescent light tubes. Then there's the organic form, which there's two different components. There's ethyl organic mercury and methyl organic mercury. Methyl is what you would find in fish. Ethyl is what you're going to find in vaccines and in thimerosal, which is the preservative that's 50% ethyl organic mercury.
I recently read a Canadian professor wrote in a letter to the editor. He said, we know that methyl mercury is toxic, but ethyl mercury is not toxic. I think in your movie you had something about a monkey feeding experiment where they fed both types to monkeys, and what did they find there?
Yeah, that is one of the biggest stances from the CDC and the FDA and all of them, that they like to claim ethyl is not like the neurotoxic methyl mercury, which is completely false. In fact, it's not only is it false, it's actually the opposite. And it's very clear. I've interviewed some of the biggest toxicologists in the world regarding this exact issue who have studied and did big, big studies, spent like a year of their time just analyzing ethyl versus methyl. And they are very clear that ethyl is at a minimum just as toxic as methyl, but more than likely more toxic. And if you follow the science, an Italian study came out showing that ethyl was actually 50 times more toxic than methyl, just on bare cells. However, at lower exposures, it was far higher than 50 times more toxic. And then if you look at how these different forms of organic mercury interact in the body and the brain, ethyl actually gets to the brain faster. It clears the blood faster. And they like to say it clears the blood faster, therefore it clears the body faster. However, if you look and kind of follow what the mercury does, and that was Burbacher's study at the University of Washington, and he looked at injecting ethyl mercury, which is thimerosal, compared to eating ethyl mercury, and found that not only does thimerosal get to the brain quicker, it actually de-ethylates. So both these forms will either de-ethylate or demethylate into an inorganic form. Mm-hmm. Organic forms cross in and out of that blood-brain barrier, wash in and out constantly. However, once it changes to the inorganic form, it locks in and accumulates, and ethyl does this substantially faster than methyl, showing that at the end of the study, there was twice the amount of inorganic mercury locked into the brain and more potential for it to accumulate in the brain. And it's very clear the science has developed and matured substantially over the last decade that shows ethyl is extremely dangerous, just as, if not far more than methyl.
And we know, like from the Minamata situation, I think it was 1950s or 60s, when output from a paper mill or something, which was, I believe, methyl mercury, went into the bay and got into people's fish. And there was this whole generation of children who had really severe neurological illnesses, permanent damage.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah, that was a major tragedy where the factory, the Chizo Corp or whatever, actually was dumping mercury into the river that fed this entire village, Minamata Bay. They ate the fish out of that bay constantly. And the ones who were the most affected were the children in utero. And the ones who were least affected were the pregnant women at the time, because actually that fetus will protect that pregnant mother from the mercury exposures by absorbing that mercury from the mother.
I'm sure if you asked most mothers if they wanted it that way, they would say no.
Right, yeah.
Yes. So thimerosal is a preservative in vaccines that started in the 1930s, and you talked about a trial in Indianapolis, which I think you said was the only safety trial of thimerosal, and all 22 people died. Like, can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, the only safety study to this day was done on, let me start over. The Eli Lilly, who invented thimerosal towards the late 1920s, they, just by coincidence, in Indianapolis, where they are located, there was an outbreak of meningitis, infections of the brain, basically, and 144 patients came down with it. And they took a subgroup of these patients, about 22 of them, and exposed them all to extremely high levels of thimerosal. It was a 1% solution, so this is far higher than you get in vaccines.
Right.
And all of them ended up dying. Most of them died within a day. And then, of course, they claimed that they died of meningitis and not the mercury. However, they had already done experiments on animals previous to that with that same exposure levels, and it was killing the animals in laboratory, too. So technically, they already found it killed animals. Then they started using it on humans. All the humans died. And then, to this day, that's the only safety study ever done on thimerosal because it was grandfathered in. FDA didn't have jurisdiction yet, and it was grandfathered in.
So a study in which everybody died, they said that everybody died of meningitis. I mean, at the very least, you would say, okay, well, it was a completely useless study because if people died after a day from meningitis, then it doesn't say anything about thimerosal toxicity, so you better do it again with healthy people this time.
Exactly.
But, of course, it's going to be hard to get 22 healthy people to line up for something that just killed 22 sick.
Right, and there was no autopsies done, so, you know, we don't know exactly how they died, but I think it was pretty clear that how they died, especially had they'd already used those exact levels on animals, and it was killing them in laboratories, adjusted for weight and size and all that kind of stuff.
You talked about a disease called pink disease, or acrodynia, to use the fancy name, which was related to teething powders and also related to autism. So can you describe that briefly?
Yeah, so I want to say it's the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, there was a teething powder called Calomel that they would rub on the gums of children when they were teething to kind of numb the pain so they wouldn't have so much pain when the teeth were coming out. And this was an inorganic mercury powder that they were rubbing into the gums, and 1 in 500 of the children who were exposed, so of all the children who were actually, Calomel was used on, 1 in 500 developed what was called acrodynia, pink disease is the other name for it. And, you know, so it hit the susceptible population, kind of like autism. Not every child that gets these vaccines with thimerosal develop autism. It hits the most susceptible. And the question is, what is the susceptibility? Well, same thing with pink disease. Only 1 in 500 children exposed got pink disease. And pink disease was almost identical, very, very similar to autism, the social withdrawal, the, you know, the loss of the eye contact and a lot of the physical symptoms. They actually would get these very clear red, weepy rashes on their hands and feet, which was kind of very indicative of pink disease. And this is an inorganic form of mercury absorbed, so it's a little different than injecting organic mercury. So, but there was very clear similarities. In fact, once the mainstream medicine acknowledged that, you know, there was a lot of reluctance to that as well, that whole issue. But once they finally pulled Calomel, pink disease, for the most part, subsided. But, you know, there's been a lot of interviews with pink disease patients or grandparents that have said what their symptoms were, and they're stunningly similar to autism. And not only that, there's a biggest study out of Australia that showed 1 in 25 grandchildren of pink disease survivors had autism compared to the general population at 1 in 160. So that, again, very, very clearly shows a genetic component to this, to mercury.
I don't know if you knew this, but skin lighteners, up till recently, several decades ago, contained mercury. These were used by dark-skinned people to try to lighten their skin for social reasons. It caused a lot of kidney failure. I believe that mercury is quite toxic to kidneys. I don't know if it caused neurological problems, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was being rubbed on the skin on a daily basis. They've since changed to using a benzene derivative for skin lighteners, so I'm not sure if that's much better. But definitely mercury is not good to put into the body.
Absolutely. And there's two different forms of mercury poisoning. There's the acute form, which would be just massive exposures that really targets the kidneys and the liver and just can kill you. You'll ultimately die of that.
Right.
And then there's chronic mercury poisoning, which is a slow build and accumulation of mercury in the brain from these bolus doses. Exposure after exposure after exposure builds in the brain and really targets senses, you know, the sensory systems and the endocrine system, immune system, and really goes after you neurologically as well.
And I guess we didn't really say this, but since mercury is a metal, if you get any foreign metal absorbed into the brain, that's going to cause havoc. I mean, that's a pretty easy thing to imagine. I've read about manganese, for example, which is used in batteries, and people who are exposed to manganese get severe neurological symptoms because it's also a metal that disrupts the normal functioning of the brain.
Yep. Yeah, mercury has just an incredible toxicity in the brain. I mean, it's been shown in animal studies to really target areas of the brain that are very related to autism. Cerebellum and limbic system is very targeted as well, and that controls your thoughts, your emotions. And it's, the key is you just cannot expose people to mercury. I mean, it is thousands, well, I don't know what the exact level, but it is extensively more toxic than lead. There's really no comparison between the toxicity of mercury compared to lead.
And you said, I believe, if I got this right, you said that the FDA standard for mercury in water is 2 parts per billion, but in vaccines it's injected at 50,000?
Yeah, there's 2 parts per billion would be the level in water of mercury that's considered safe. 200 parts per billion is what they would classify as hazardous waste. And then 50,000 mm-hmm. parts per billion is the mercury in one of the standard vaccine shots. Most of the vaccine shots with thimerosal have 25 micrograms of mercury. There are some, like hepatitis B, that used to have 12.5 micrograms of mercury. But if you look at the majority of the shots with mercury, like the flu shots today, they have 50,000 parts per billion.
And
to receive one of those shots, you'd have to weigh 551 pounds to be within a federal guideline.
Right. And I mean, another thing that people often get confused about is the difference between eating something and having it injected. Like, people say there's a certain amount of mercury in tuna, for example. But generally, anything that's eaten, your body is going to process. And even if it tries to, it's not going to absorb everything. Whereas if it's injected into the bloodstream, it's 100% in the body.
That's a great point. Especially when you eat fish with mercury, let's say. A lot of that mercury is bound up tight with selenium. Or, your body process, it goes right through you.
It's
a lot different than injecting directly intramuscularly or whatever, where it's 100% absorption into the body.
Right.
But the direct route to the brain, basically.
Another point you made, which I thought was interesting, I had not thought of, is that if you leave a bottle of vaccine standing, the mercury tends to sink to the bottom. And so what that means is if you don't shake the bottle, that the person who gets the last dose of vaccine is going to get much more mercury than the person who got the first dose. And so the 50,000 parts per billion, that's an average, but it could be more than that.
Yeah, I mean, each dose in a 10-dose vial should contain 25 micrograms of mercury. And when we tested the vaccines, when we shook them good, each dose was 25 micrograms. But if we let it sit for just 20 minutes, and that's not even letting it sit overnight, and we pulled one from the bottom there, it was 27 micrograms. So, if you're the 8th, 9th, or 10th dose, after, let's say, some people were getting 18 or 15 micrograms of mercury, you potentially get 50 micrograms of mercury in one shot if you're the last dose in that bottle.
Right. And how, when you said that in the movie, I thought, well, that's really obvious, but I would not have thought of that. Like, if I was giving vaccines, I wouldn't have thought, well, I need to shake the vial because I need to distribute the mercury so it's not toxic.
Right. And the other... one of the biggest things out there right now, everyone kind of believes this is a mute issue at this point, because all over the news you'll see mercury's been removed clear back in 1999. The rates keep going up. Therefore, mercury is playing no role in this autism rate. And that couldn't be further from the truth. There's so much misinformation given on the news media because they don't look at the studies. So what ended up happening was they started phasing out mercury in 1999 because they realized they finally did the math of how much exposure these kids were getting. They freaked out.
Right.
American Academy of Pediatrics said, we need to remove it from vaccines as soon as possible. That was their exact words. Well, that was 1999. They continued manufacturing the vaccine through 2001. Backstock lasted at least through 2003, and I've seen expiration dates as far out as 2005. So 2003 is a very generous number. And if you look at the autism rate of today of 1 in 68, those children were born in 2002. So they got the fully loaded backstock of thimerosal-loaded vaccines and started getting flu shots in 2004. So potentially this is the highest exposure group yet.
Let's talk about the vaccines that are still have mercury in them, thimerosal. So the flu vaccine is one. Are there other common vaccines that still have thimerosal?
Those that still have thimerosal are, the flu shot, which is the biggest problem right now because those are given to pregnant women. And also some tetanus vaccines have it, as well as meningitis. So for childhood vaccines, the biggest threat right now is flu shots given to pregnant women, 60 million doses with the full 25 micrograms of mercury. Were manufactured this year and given to pregnant women, babies, and everyone else, for that matter. We don't know who got what of those 60 million, but it is a major problem to inject pregnant women. In 2009, 2010, they gave pregnant women two of these doses because the swine flu vaccine also had the full 25 micrograms of mercury. That had never been done before to give a pregnant woman two of these shots, and we know that fetus will draw all that mercury into the fetus and protect the mother. It's got a high affinity for the fetus.
I try to understand what organizations like the CDC do, what they're thinking. But why did they? Do you have any idea why they started recommending a flu vaccine for pregnant women?
You know, that is the number one question I get after people watch this film, because when they watch this film, they see that the CDC figured this out. They did the big study in the vaccine safety data link. They figured out the cause of autism, and for 5 years covered it up and whitewashed the data and manipulated the results and published the studies. And then after that, as soon as that mercury was removed from the backstock of a lot of the childhood vaccines, right as that problem was somewhat resolved, they add flu shots to pregnant women and babies to the first year of life and whatever year after that, and just throw mercury right back into the childhood vaccine schedule. But this time it's far worse because you're giving it to a pregnant mother with a developing fetus, which the whole theory of mercury causing autism is it affects those who can excrete it the least affected. Well, a developing fetus can't excrete it at all. So now you've taken that out, and you're injecting the most susceptible population. Not only are they like 0.2, 0.4, 0.5 pounds, and not a 10-pound baby, they have zero ability to excrete because they're not sweating, they're not producing bile. If they're urinating, it's recycling. They're not really growing hair. It is the most susceptible population, and to do that is almost unfathomable given that they figured the cause out in 1999 when they did the initial study with thimerosal and autism.
Maybe it's as simple as the left hand not talking to the right hand, and the people who were really thinking about mercury didn't want to talk about it, and the people in charge of promoting the flu vaccine just said, well, gee, what's our most vulnerable population? Well, we don't want pregnant women dying of the flu. Like you can never underestimate the stupidity of a bureaucracy, I think.
Exactly. Yeah.
And you look for a reason, and there might not actually be a logical reason.
Well, here's the reason that Bill Thompson, who's this 17-year senior CDC scientist that still works there today, his belief is, and I've got all the transcripts of his phone calls with Brian Hooker,
right,
he believes that the only reason they've now left it in the flu shot is because they would never be able to justify giving these fully thimerosal-loaded vaccines to developing countries, which we are. We didn't remove any of the mercury from their vaccines. Developing countries are getting just flooded with these. And we could never have justified it had we removed it from everything in the U.S. And that's what Bill Thompson, the CDC guy, believes. And I've also got emails that kind of, when they figured all this out, they were very clear of how concerned they were if they remove it from U.S. vaccines, that they would never be able to justify giving it to these developing countries. So there might be a lot more to this than what we think.
Right. So just an economic motivation. So you're saying if they figured a way to get thimerosal out of the flu vaccine, and they could proudly state that we in America no longer inject any mercury in vaccines, then, people in Africa would be saying, how come we're still getting vaccines with mercury?
Yeah,
why is it not a problem for us?
Yep, exactly. And, I just went to the United Nations for a conference in Bangkok, Thailand back in November, and, they've the United Nations is doing a great thing and trying to do a big global treaty to ban mercury products and mercury exposures and all that kind of stuff. And over a period of, you know, four or five sessions, which were every 10 months, the American Academy of Pediatrics and the World Health Organization convinced them to exclude thimerosal from this ban because they need to give thimerosal to these developing countries in their vaccines. And then I went there and showed a lot of these delegates my film after they've been told year after year that there's not one shred of evidence of harm from thimerosal. They watched my film, and they were in an uproar. One Botswanian lady said she doesn't even know how she's going back to her country knowing this information. The Russians were in an uproar over this. They have been, they are just getting, you know, their children are in major harm's way right now because of what our organizations, World Health Organization and the American Academy of Pediatrics have done to continue this nonsense. Flu shots in America, we could remove thimerosal instantly without affecting the supply at all. It's been done in a lot of these other childhood vaccines. It needed to be removed. The only reason it wasn't removed is because it wasn't a childhood vaccine at the time that joint statement was made. And the second all those others ran out, they put it right back in. It's just, you know, they just moved the mercury around is all they've done. And they moved it around in a very, very catastrophic way as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Now, you talked, one of the most strange episodes in this whole thing from, what's the expression that there's lies, there's damn lies, and there's statistics. But you talked about how, pardon me?
Oh, I just said yeah.
Yeah, okay. In November of 1999, a researcher named Vera Stratton, who seems to be very important in this vaccine story, did some analysis internal for the CDC and concluded that the risk ratio of high exposure to thimerosal versus low exposure was 7.6, which is approximately means that children that got higher doses of thimerosal were almost eight times more likely to be autistic. And he reanalyzed that in December 1999, and it went up to 11.35. But then over the next few years, he got it down to 1.5 in 2002, which was published by the IOM Institute of Medicine. And then he eventually got it down to 1, which basically means there's no risk. So can you briefly describe how he managed to manipulate the data?
Yeah, so when he initially found, he ran his initial results and found this astronomical relative risk. 7.62 was incredibly high. You know, a relative risk of 2 would be found in a court of law, basically a cause and effect. So, I mean, this is extremely high. And then they found the 11.35, and then what they started to do was stratify the data. So they're basically breaking the kids into subgroups, and then they used exclusion criteria to basically eliminate half the children in the population. And they were excluding kids that had, you know, that were more susceptible. They were also excluding things like the hepatitis B vaccine, children who got that. And that had 12.5 micrograms of mercury in it.
Right.
Then they started including these HMOs that barely even, you know, had records. So they could just kind of sort through the data and pull and find and whatever they wanted. I mean, this data that they started using, I think it was a pilgrimage HMO, I want to say, that they added, that just added all sorts of whitewash into the study. And then what they also did was, instead of comparing those who got the highest exposure to the lowest exposure, they took those who got a little, you know, took those who got less mercury and compared those who got a little more. So they basically took the extremes, drove them towards the middle, and the further you get towards the middle, comparing instead of, let's say, 75 micrograms to 0 micrograms, they're comparing, you know, 29 or 30 to 32 or something to that effect. So, I mean, they basically did everything they could to get these numbers down to a relative risk of 1, and that's what they published, that there was no association. In fact, in the study it says in no analysis did they find any increased association between thimerosal and autism. It was unbelievable. But Stratton was gone before the study was even published. For the last year, he was working for GlaxoSmithKline, and the CDC brought in these other guys to take it over and really get that number down. Because Stratton was resisting it. He was very frustrated by people questioning his numbers, telling him that this can't be. If you look at the Faroe and Seychelles Island studies of mercury, there's no way he should be finding this kind of effect at these exposure levels. And he was resistant. In fact, he even wrote an email kind of scathing them that they need to use sound scientific argumentation instead of, you know, being swayed by their wanting to
make it go away. But, I mean, he wasn't so upset about the whole thing that he didn't, you know, go and work for one of the biggest vaccine manufacturers.
Like, I know.
Do you think that he's trying to get GlaxoSmithKline? I mean, does GlaxoSmithKline produce vaccines that have thimerosal, or is it just Eli Lilly?
Oh, yeah. No, Eli Lilly doesn't even make the vaccines with thimerosal. They're just the thimerosal maker, or inventor. They don't even hold the patent anymore. They're the ones that invented it and made it, made trillions of dollars off it. But the vaccine makers like Merck, GlaxoSmithKline, and those guys are the ones that make the vaccines and use thimerosal as the preservative.
Right. There are some really interesting people in this movie. I think the vast majority of bureaucrats, I mean, even the top bureaucrats, are not really interesting people. They're just trying to stop what would to them be a catastrophe of being blamed for poisoning people with mercury. But there was the one, was she the head of the CDC, Bernadine Healy, who spoke out about thimerosal? I thought that was an interesting...
Dr. Bernadine Healy was the head of the National Institutes of Health. She's the one that really stood up to her colleagues and said they're afraid to do this research because they're afraid of what they might find. And she really, really stood up and called it out as it was. And many doctors say, you know, Bernadine didn't know what the rats in the basement were up to. That's kind of the way they put it. And once she kind of keyed in on it, she made public statements, came out to the national press and said, look, there may be a susceptible group here. And the fact that we don't want to know that susceptible group was very damning to her. And she has since died of a brain tumor, unfortunately, because she was a big voice, the biggest voice yet to stand up against this and say, hey, something else is going on here. We need to look at it.
Right. I think more of the people in so-called public health are like Paul Offit, whose name is everywhere these days. I think, did he say that human beings could have 10,000 vaccinations without any harm?
Yes.
Something like that. But he has some pretty significant financial conflicts of interest, correct?
Right. Yeah, he was a co-founder with Merck of a rotavirus vaccine where he made millions of dollars. And he's got big ties with Merck, and he's got a lot of interest at stake here, let's put it that way. He's also part of the advisory committee of immunization practices that recommends what vaccines children get and which ones they don't. So there's substantial conflicts of interest, and he claims to be, and everyone kind of views him as the expert from the side that says thimerosal is not causing autism, yet he knows almost nothing about what mercury is and what it can do to you. And he knows almost nothing about children with autism. So he is not an expert in either of those fields, yet he is the go-to guy that says thimerosal does not cause autism.
Right. And how did you actually get to interview him? Because you think that he would shy away from this. I mean, did you have difficulty getting him to agree?
No, I called him, and he agreed to interview. I think one good thing I'll say about him is he's very confident and believes in what he says.
Yeah,
and he'll speak, and I got to give him big time credit for interviewing with us, and that goes a long way in my book. Is people who have a stance and a statement and want to make a statement, when they talk to people, on the other side, that goes a long way with me. So I give him a lot of props for that. At the same time, I really wanted to get to him, ask him about the science, because every time I see him on national news, he says the science disproves this, the science disproves it, and I know the science inside and out, and I know it's the actual opposite. It is completely the opposite of what he's saying on national news, but nobody ever asks him about the science or says one thing about this one study. So I wanted to go there to see what science he's using to prove this. And, at that time, I interviewed him in 2008, his definitive study was the Thompson study, which, first of all, excludes children with autism or doesn't look at autism as a factor at all. It excludes that condition. And second of all, Bill Thompson is the guy that just came out saying that he was pressured to manipulate the data on that study to show ticks, show less of an association with ticks. And ticks are highly associated with autism. So
I definitely choked when he brought out the Thompson study. Of course, back in 2008, people didn't know that Thompson would come out and say this, but still, either he was very naive or he knew that there were some problems. Another interesting people on the other side is the Geyers, the father-son team that seem to be very knowledgeable about mercury and have been fighting this battle for a long time.
Yep, they've been on this, I can't remember when they got started, around 2000. They've been at least 2002, because I've saw all sorts of testimony of theirs in congressional hearings in 2002, so they've been on this a long time. They don't have any fight in this. You know, they didn't have a child with autism. They didn't
right.
have any relatives with autism. They're ones that started looking into this and realizing, as they started looking at the science, that there is something much more going on here. And once they started really analyzing the data, they went after it like no other. And these guys, I'll tell you, as far as the history of this subject, I have not come across anybody that knows it better. Really, these guys know this inside out, upside down, left, right, and sideways. I mean, it's incredible the vast amount of knowledge they've got. They are very controversial because they have used treatments on children with autism that many consider dangerous, and they've been just crucified for some of the studies they've published. So they're a very controversial team. But I'm telling you, I've interviewed everyone from all sides of this now, every organization and everyone, and there really is nobody that knows this better than them. I'm not saying they're 100% right. I can't verify that, but I do know, as far as the history, because I know the history very well
right.
at this point now, they know this subject incredibly well.
Actually, a question talking about mercury, and you had made the good point that mercury's not gone out of vaccines, but the study that Thompson manipulated was a study of the MMR vaccine, and my understanding is that it does not contain mercury. Is that correct?
Well, Bill Thompson had a role in three big studies, one being the Thompson study. That's the big Cimerosal study. He also had done one in 2000, that was in 2007. He had done one in 2004 regarding the MMR vaccine.
Right.
And then he did another one. He was involved in. He wasn't the lead author, but he was second on the list there. In 2010, which was the Price study, and that was another one looking at Cimerosal specific to autism. And that's the one where they found not only does it not cause autism, it protects children from autism. So we've got all the data behind it that shows it had they found a relative risk of 8.73 when looking at regressive autism based on exposures in, prenatal exposures in utero. So the MMR study is the one that Brian Hooker reanalyzed the data on.
Right.
And found that they had excluded children, some African-American children that didn't have valid birth certificates.
Right.
So they left those children out, which kind of reduced the relative risk that they had found amongst African-American boys and the MMR vaccine. So, I don't know too much to do with that study because I focus so much on thimerosal, but
mm-hmm.
I do know that those children who got MMR vaccine, let's put it this way, also at the same time got two thimerosal-loaded shots. So unless you isolate thimerosal out of that study, which I have talked to Brian Hooker about, and it wasn't done, there's no telling if that relative risk is associated with MMR or the thimerosal vaccines they got the same day. And then talking to the guy who analyzed the data set actually showed that when you look at the thimerosal side of it, when you take the thimerosal lower versus higher exposed groups, if you compare those, the relative risk goes away if you factor in the thimerosal. So they suspect that it's a clear link with thimerosal and not the MMR vaccine. Let's just put it that way.
Okay, so maybe the MMR vaccine is just a canary in that it's been added to the list, but it's not that it itself is so dangerous. I'm not saying that, for people listening, I'm not saying the MMR vaccine isn't dangerous, but it would be possible that as you add more vaccines, you will notice that after the MMR vaccine came out, there was a higher risk of autism, but that could be from other factors, such as other vaccines containing mercury.
Yeah, and this wasn't the case where they added the vaccine to the schedule and it increased the risks. That never happened. This was more of a factor. They were just looking at children who had gotten the MMR vaccine by a certain time, by a certain year, a certain age,
right.
compared to those who didn't. So when they looked
right.
at that, they found that association. And all I'm saying, because I don't know what role MMR plays. It might play a significant role in autism. I just don't know. I haven't looked into it enough. I'm just saying that same study, those children who got the MMR vaccine, if you look at the same vaccines they got with that MMR that same day with thimerosal, you need to really compare MMR versus the shots they got with thimerosal. And once you do that, for the Geyers, when they analyzed the data, said that it was linked directly to thimerosal and not the MMR.
Okay. One thing you talked about was the interaction between aluminum, which is, I think, found in virtually all vaccines, and mercury, which is found in some vaccines. And you show a picture of metallic mercury and metallic aluminum reacting quite vigorously. But are there experiments on how organic mercury and the type of aluminum that's used in vaccines, how they interact in the body, and are they toxic, more toxic together than they are separately?
I do know of one study that Boyd Haley did where he looked, and it wasn't in the body on humans or any animal subjects, it was in petri dish on brain neurons, and found that at one point in the dying of neurons, when there was 10% death by the thimerosal alone, there was 60% neuron death with thimerosal and aluminum. So, you know, there is a very big synergy, and that's well known. In fact, even at Simpsonwood Conference, they talked about the synergy and how they hadn't even acknowledged or looked at the synergy between aluminum and mercury and how it makes things much more toxic. If you look at in airports, they don't allow mercury in airplanes or jets at all, and that's because the aluminum, because mercury will burn right through it and put a hole right in the jet.
Oh.
So, you know, it's very well known that there's a big synergy between the two, and even the thimerosal MSDS sheet, the material safety and data sheet that shows all the safety data information on thimerosal, says it should never be combined with aluminum because, in fact, it reads violent reactions possible when combined with aluminum. So, I mean, for them to do this, it's serious. There's just so much gross negligence behind this. These guys literally have no idea what they're doing. In fact, in a certain year, they started recommending all parents give their babies Tylenol before coming in and getting their vaccines. Well, the acetaminophen suppresses glutathione, which is the key for any baby to be able to excrete mercury. So now they just gave them Tylenol, brought them in to get these shots, dosed them with mercury. Their glutathione levels are low, and it just ravaged them. So, I mean, there's so much, like I said, so much gross negligence within the CDC and FDA and AAP. They literally have no idea what they're doing, and it has caused a massive worldwide disaster that's almost worse than ever right now.
I see your point, especially about the third world. Anyway, let's talk a little bit about your story. You had a tetanus vaccine that you believe caused your problems, although you didn't actually realize it was a vaccine until sometime afterwards. But what happened to you after you got the tetanus vaccine?
I got a tetanus shot when I was 24. Sorry, I was 29. It was the year 2004. And, you know, right away I came down with flu-like symptoms, probably within a day. Flu-like symptoms, nausea, all that kind of stuff, dizziness. And then it kind of pulled out of that, and then symptoms further developed into just major, you know, I felt like I was getting sick again. And then I had more dizziness and shakiness, and then my ears, sensitivity to noise came in. I woke up one morning, and it's like somebody turned up the volume in my ears, and that went into my vision where I had major sensitivity to light and tracers in my vision and distorted vision. And then it really, you know, developed into muscle twitching and rashes all over and tremors. And it just went big time neurological, you know, kind of off the deep end neurologically and psychologically. And my whole life history was basically solved with that last tetanus shot, the thimerosal in there. You know, it was kind of the final straw and the final tipping point accumulated in my brain that really threw me over the edge with symptoms. And once I went through a process, once it was all figured out, and it was a very huge process to try to get it figured out, because I was seeing every neurologist you can imagine and every doctor out there trying to get to the bottom of this. What I ended up doing was backtracking daily when all these symptoms started. Like, to the day I was building my fence and I scratched my top of my head with a rusty nail, and I went down and got a tetanus shot. And when I back to that day, I went back to my neurologist. I'm like, look, I got tetanus. It's the only explanation for this. I scratched my head this exact day. This is when everything started. And he's like, there's no chance it's tetanus, first of all. And second of all, you know, my symptoms didn't match, and I did get a tetanus shot within an hour of getting the the rusty hit. So he ruled it out instantly. And I remember just going back, and I was just lost at this point. This was weeks into trying to figure out what was going on, and my legs were literally shutting down. I was going into a really bad state physically. And I went back, and I was just like, just so over it, trying to figure it out. And I pulled up my laptop, and I typed in mercury poisoning tetanus shot, because I'd already come across mercury in my research, and every one of my symptoms led me to mercury poisoning. But I kept saying, you know, where would I have gotten a mercury exposure? And I asked one of my other neurologists, and he's like, no, there's no way this is mercury. It could just make your foot go numb. But I realized he didn't know what he was talking about, first of all. But second of all, I ruled it out, too, because I'm like, where would I have gotten a mercury exposure?
Right.
So it was weeks later when I came, you know, I backtracked my symptoms to that rusty nail, and that's why I thought I had tetanus. And once I typed in those four keywords, the 1,000 light bulbs came on, and I'm like, why is there mercury in these shots? And I went to engineering school. I knew, I took a lot of chemistries.
Right.
I knew how toxic this stuff was. How could there possibly be mercury in the shots? And I went back down to the urgent care and asked them for the lot information on the tetanus shot I got, and they're like, well, why do you need that? I'm like, well, I think your shot gave me mercury poisoning. And they're like, there's no mercury in that shot. And so I'm like, all right, I'll figure that out. They gave me the lot information, and sure enough, it had one part per 10,000, which is 25 micrograms, where I would have had to weigh 551 pounds to be within the guideline.
Right.
And that guideline stopped eating fish, not injecting ethyl mercury, which is more dangerous. So,
right. And why does the tetanus shot have mercury in it? Because it's a single-dose vaccine, right?
Yeah, that's the biggest disaster of it all. It has nothing to do with the efficacy of the vaccine at all. It's simply to save pharmaceutical companies money. They can be lazy and unsterile during the manufacturing of the vaccines, so they can just dump a bunch of thimerosal in there and not worry about bacteria growing, and then they can have 10-dose vial and have less shipping expenses and have, you know, a 10-dose vial instead of 10 single-dose vials. And it's just because of its shelf life. So it's literally they're saving money putting in the entire human race
at risk.
And it has nothing to do with the efficacy of the vaccine at all. That's the biggest tragedy of this. If it did, you know, it would be a whole different story as far as what I'd be doing with this film, because there is a risk. There would be a risk versus reward, and I would still have to analyze the risk versus reward. But still, there's zero risk versus reward to thimerosal, because the only risk is to humans, and the only reward is to Big Pharma.
Right, and it's not like they couldn't produce vaccines without thimerosal. It just would cost a little bit more.
Yeah. So it's
I guess the proof that it was the mercury is that once you started to remove the mercury from your body, your symptoms went away. And I think you said you used alpha-lipoic acid.
That was the biggest thing. Because, you know, there was still a question. We did do a mercury challenge test that showed mercury elevated and nothing else elevated. So mercury was not in the elevated range. Nothing else was even shown, hardly.
Right.
Like lead, aluminum, those were nothing, if anything. And then once I started going through the treatment that removes it from your body and brain, within 6 months, all my symptoms were gone. So it was the validation of what it really was. And then, you know, as you saw in the movie, that wasn't the first round. ended up getting sick again, which further validated that it's mercury.
Right. I was a little unclear in the movie about what happened the second time, because you said that when you started, you were exposed to fluorescent light bulbs. Somebody had broken some fluorescent light bulbs, which presumably contained mercury vapor.
Yeah, when you break a 4-foot fluorescent light tube, it's mercury vapors. You can't see or smell the vapors. But you try to sweep it up, those vapors are going to go all around the room. And I was, by coincidence, I used to manage the design and construction of pharmaceutical manufacturing suites. And I was back to work building a manufacturing suite. And somebody had broken 3 of those 4-foot fluorescent light tubes within a few feet of me, and was sweeping them up. And I remember looking at them. And I didn't know. I thought you'd have to touch it to get sick, to be exposed. And I do remember in my head thinking, oh, we'll see if I get sick again. And sure enough, I went into an incredible worse sickness than the first time.
And did it take longer to chelate the mercury, or did you have to do something different this time?
Yeah, it was substantially worse because I had such a severe problem with systemic candida, and the drugs I would take to get the mercury out of me are sulfur-based, and those feed candida. So I had to take a year and just take a drug that was antifungal to kill off the yeast, and then when I got that under control, I was too scared to take the sulfur drugs to feed the yeast, so I did it. By that time, I was already interviewing doctors and scientists, and I came across all sorts of science that showed ways that I could boost my glutathione levels naturally within my body. And because my glutathione was lower, on the lower end, let's put it that way. And my cysteine, which is another sulfur-based protein that helps you excrete mercury, that was lower than my doctor's ever seen. So I was a sitting duck when I got exposures to mercury that I could not excrete it. And my testosterone was high, which is very synergistic with mercury. And that's why there's four to five boys every girl with autism. Testosterone actually is very synergistic with mercury, and estrogen protects you from it. So,
okay.
The second round was much worse, but I found a lot of natural ways to get my glutathione levels up that really pulled me out of it in the end. But it took a few years rather than 6 months.
So, does alpha lipoic acid affect glutathione, or does it operate on the mercury itself?
Glutathione is water soluble and a double thiol, so it'll cross the blood-brain barrier, and it'll bind to mercury. So by itself, it can excrete mercury out of your brain, and used in combination with other chelating drugs,
will help get it out the body. But I think ethylcholic acid is also a, don't quote me on this, but I think it's also a precursor to glutathione, so it does help maybe produce glutathione, but I'm not positive on that one. I can't remember.
Yeah. One of the big things that I've seen with vaccines recently, you know, a little while after the Bill Thompson statement came out, and there's some Merck whistleblowers who have a court case, and there's been other bad things about vaccines. There's been this incredible increase in censorship on vaccines recently, and I'm sure you've observed this, where it's virtually impossible in the mainstream media to have any questions about vaccines over the past, say, 3-4 months.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. In fact, one thing that I've been seeing, because we've been touring the country now, having screening after screening and holding events with Bobby Kennedy and all sorts of people, is that the most big journalists who were completely on the other side of me to begin with and calling me anti-vaccine, they watch this film and they come to my side, and it's happened over and over and over. But they're too scared to write about it because, they, first of all, they've been writing about it from the other side for so long, and they're embarrassed. But once they see this film and see the CDC's documents that were obtained through the Freedom of Information Act, and they hear Bill Thompson, the senior CDC scientist, and they see all this stuff that they've never heard before and all the science that shows it down to the cell, you know, they come to my side every time. And I've yet to have one that hasn't. And same with, you know, other people who aren't journalists. I'm talking doctors who come in there and come out, walk out of there saying they've been so misled, they can't believe what they just saw. They've trusted the CDC, and they cannot literally fathom that this has taken place. And they were the most staunch supporter of of vaccines, and there's no harm being caused. And then they watch this, and they are absolutely pissed, for lack of a better word.
Right. I mean, doctors are a special case. In the part of Canada I live in, the leader of one of the political parties is an MD, and he recently said we should have mandatory vaccination in Alberta, in Canada. So I wrote to him and put together just a little dossier of some of the information, the Thompson statement, a list of, summary of the amount of money that's been paid for vaccine adverse reactions by the U.S., the number of adverse reactions, some of the information on the HPV vaccine, and things like that. And he wrote back and said, we're just going to have to agree to disagree. Like, he just would not address the issue.
Right.
But it's not going to stop him from, going forwards with pushing vaccines harder on people who are resistant. Now, one of the things related to this in the Simpsonwood meeting, which we don't have time to go into, but it was kind of a secret meeting to discuss a lot of these things. I think you noted it a couple times in our discussions. There was an anecdote where I think the chairman had a new grandson while he was at the meetings, and told his son or daughter to not use thimerosal. Can you describe that?
Yeah. I mean, this is one of the things in the film that is most compelling to me is, you know, they had private meetings that they didn't invite the press or public to, closed door, basically locked door meetings with pharmaceutical companies and government organizations like the FDA, CDC, and all them to discuss this initial verstratin study, the results, and seeing these high elevated risks for not only autism but other neurodevelopmental disorders as well. So they were analyzing all the data sets. And at the end of discussion, towards the end of discussion, the chairman of the panel stood up and said that he had just got a call and his son had just had a boy, a new baby, and that he wanted to call them right away and tell them, do not get one of these vaccines with thimerosal. And this is literally right after he had just got done voting a one, so they had asked all the panel members to vote on a scale of 1 to 6, how serious they felt these findings were, and the majority of them voted 1 or 2, basically saying no, not very concerned at all. And then he goes out and calls his grandson, or, you know, wants to make sure his grandson doesn't get any of these shots right away. So, I mean, these people, when it came to the rest of the American public, he doesn't care. He voted a one, not concerned at all, and then does this. I mean, it is infuriating to see that.
Yeah, that is really awful. We're coming towards the end of the hour, I would just like to let people know how they can get to see your movie now. I know you're on tour. Is it going to be in film festivals? Can people purchase the movie? How do you get a hold of it?
Yeah, right now the biggest, you can go to traceamounts.com and get all the information, but the biggest thing is April 2nd, which is, I believe, Thursday, I want to say, we go live, and people can go to our website, traceamounts.com, and they can rent it, they can download it, buy DVDs. We're going fully live to the world, basically, as of April 2nd. So, you know, we'd love everyone to watch it, spread the word. I mean, this is information that is almost dire need for the public to see to protect their families from these exposures. And we've got to somehow streamline the mainstream media and get this out in different ways, because you're right, the mainstream media will not talk about this because all their commercials, are billions of dollars worth of commercials, are paid by Big Pharma, who will not allow this to be talked about in these big mainstream networks.
Yeah, and I would like to say that for people who might be thinking about listening to this, is that the film, in my opinion, strikes a really good balance between being a good film, you know, interesting and keeping your attention, while addressing the scientific issues in an adult way. It's not trying to dumb down the science. It's giving you a lot of facts, and it's a good jumping off place for people who know nothing about this. If you wanted to do more investigations, it would be a good way to start. But certainly, if you're kind of skeptical about this whole mercury autism connection, it's definitely worth reading, and definitely worth watching. And you know, it'd be easy to follow up on some of the claims that are made, because the papers are out there, and you can definitely read them. So, thank you very much for bringing this to the public. I think it's going to be a very important step forward in the fight against mercury poisoning.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, well, thank you, and I'll let you know when this is posted.
Perfect. Appreciate it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, bye. Goodbye.